Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Among our stories tonight, an appalling and offensive stunt. The major parties condemn One Nation leader Pauline Hanson for wearing a burqa in the Senate chamber. Telstra shares punished by investors after the telco slashes dividends. And as more and more kids go online, can they teach themselves how to spot and avoid fake news?
Oh, that's a scary photo. Do you think that's real?
No.
Each generation is like more familiar with technology, but with fake news and spam and stuff, they might need quite a bit of teaching.
Do you think that's real?
That's not real.
There, that's just Photoshop.
Senator Pauline Hanson's been given a verbal smackdown by the Attorney General for wearing an Islamic head covering into Parliament. Senator Hanson pulled the stunt to demand that the government move to ban the burqa. But her actions appear to have backfired. She's been swiftly rebuked by both sides of the chamber. George Roberts reports from Parliament.
And I would ask you to reflect on what you have done.
Order.
In a rare show of cross-party support, Labor, Green and some crossbench senators gave the Attorney General a standing ovation for his emotional and blistering response to Pauline Hanson's stunt. The One Nation senator caused disruption in the Senate, arriving wearing the part of the burqa that completely covers the face, head and shoulders. The Senate President is Stephen Parry.
Senators, order. Senators, I've been advised by the clerk via the attendant that the identity of Senator Hanson was established before she entered the chamber. I'm just going to reflect on the mode of dress that Senator Hanson is using, but we'll continue with question time.
Right-wing Conservative Corey Bernardi told 2GB he found the stunt confronting but agrees with Pauline Hanson's push for a burqa ban.
I don't know anybody that goes, oh, look at that, we need more of that in our country. I jumped. I was literally scared because I was, you know, assaulted, in effect, visually, by some alien being coming into the parliament.
About 20 minutes into question time, Senator Hanson threw the Islamic head covering off onto the seat.
I'm quite happy to remove this because this is not what should belong in this parliament.
And launched her line of questioning.
In light of our national security of this nation, will you work with the... Will
Order
you work...
On my left.
To
on my left.
Ban the burqa.
George Brandis schooled Ms. Hanson of the security implications of ostracising the Islamic community.
Now, Senator Hanson, for the last 4 years, I have had responsibility preeminently among the ministers, subject to the Prime Minister, for national security policy. And I can tell you, Senator Hanson, that it has been the advice of each Director General of Security with whom I have worked, and each Commissioner of the Australian Federal Police with whom I have worked, that it is vital for their intelligence and law enforcement work that they work cooperatively with the Muslim community. And to ridicule that community, to drive it into a corner, to mock its religious garments, is an appalling thing to do. And I would ask you to reflect on what you have done.
Order.
The Attorney General's response galvanised the major parties, drawing applause from Coalition, Labor and Green MPs. Labor's leader in the Senate is Penny Wong.
If I had the opportunity, I would move to congratulate the leader of the government on that statement. Well, and I make this point on behalf of all of us on this side of the chamber.
There is
one thing to wear religious dress as a sincere act of faith. It is another to wear it as a stunt here in the Senate chamber.
Senator Wong.
Senator Hanson pressed on, asking if the government would ban the burqa in public spaces.
Will the government make changes to these laws?
Attorney General.
No.
The Greens leader, Richard Di Natale, used a question to get his point across.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, today in this chamber we've seen the most disgraceful, disrespectful, shameful behaviour with a senator of this parliament mocking a community of decent, hard-working, law-abiding citizens of this country.
Senator Nick Xenophon wasn't in the chamber but joined other crossbenchers like Darren Hinch in applauding the government's response.
Unfortunately, I wasn't in the Senate because if I was, I too would have stood up and applauded along with my colleagues for the statement of Senator Brandis in response to Senator Hanson's toxic behaviour. Senator Brandis spoke like a true statesman. He displayed the leadership and clarity of purpose that this country needs on issues such as this. So good on you, George. He's shown what it means to be a statesman in circumstances where many other politicians would have shied away.
Senator Nick Xenophon ending George Roberts' reports. Tasneem Chopra is the chairwoman of the Australian Muslim Women's Centre for Human Rights. I spoke to her a short time ago and got her reaction to the day's events in Parliament. Tasneem Chopra, what's your reaction to seeing Senator Hanson wearing what I understand is part of a burqa in the Senate chamber today?
Yeah, my initial reaction was I was incredulous that such a juvenile technique could be actually deployed in Parliament today. Then there was, you know, the whole theatrics versus mockery, and I'm trying to decide, you know, where it's landed. And I say theatrics because it's a costume for her. She's not obviously a Muslim, but she's decided to make a provocative point. And I say mockery because I spoke to some young adolescent Muslim girls this evening, and some of them laughed it off, thought it was hilarious because they just thought, she's got zero credibility anymore. But the others were offended. They thought, why would she take what is important to some women in an effort to make a joke or to be, you know, to be provocative? And they found it, you know, a little bit hurtful. So I thought, you know, if she's been trying to make a point to the Australian public, what she's actually done is undermined her credibility as an elected official.
It's obviously not a costume, as you call it, to the women who wear it. What
Absolutely
actually
not.
Is the significance of the burqa or other Islamic headdresses to the women who wear them?
Look, I think symbols of faith are precisely that to the individual. They're a very personal expression of belief and adherence. So it will vary according to a person's individual state of religiosity. And, it, you know, I'd say the majority of Muslim women in this country don't even wear a head covering. And of those that do, it will vary from, you know, maybe a hijab to something a little longer to, you know, a very, very minuscule proportion who actually wear a niqab. The burqa, as was what was worn by the Senate today, is actually not worn, in my opinion, experience by anyone that I've met, and I'd venture to say I know a lot more Muslim women than a senator. So the niqab is different; it does show the eyes, but covers the rest of the face, and that is, you know, that's worn, if anything at all, in this country.
There have been problems in recent times with the women trying to wear the burqa in court and problems of identifying them, those sort of things. You say not many women wear it in Australia. Do you think Islamic women should be able to wear the full burqa in Australia?
I think Muslim women who choose to wear the niqab or not wear the niqab should be entitled the freedom to do precisely that in a democracy. Now, you go to other countries, and I've heard this, you know, spouted at me all the time, well, in Saudi Arabia, they make you dress like X, Y, and Z. And I said, I know. Aren't we lucky we live in a democracy where we can choose what we wear, whether we choose to wear a burqa or hot pants under our burqa? That's the whole blessed benefit of living in a society. So I think women and Indian Buddhists, Sikhs, whatever the expression of religious faith a person has, the objective of a democracy is to enable that expression.
What do you say to people who see the various Islamic head coverings as symbols of oppression of Islamic women?
I'd say go and ask one. Go and speak to the women and ask them how they feel about it. It's easy for us to make assumptions and assertions based on hype quite readily, but typically women are excluded from debates about them, whether it's head coverings, whether it's, you know, honestly, whether it's reproductive rights even to some extent. So I think we really need to engage those participants in a debate which they are the centre of and not speak about them but speak to them, like we are now. I don't wear any caps. I'm not going to speak on behalf of them. But the conversations that I've had with them and the women that I know who do wear one have all chosen to wear it, many often in defiance of their family or defiance of their partners, will continue to wear a niqab because for them it's very much connected to their spiritual expression, and it is a choice. And the third thing I would say is that in terms of the security link, conversations again heard on radio with intelligence, including police, ASIO, banks, airport security, have all verified that when a woman with a face covering presents, they have a method and a process for making the identity known. And in Senator Hanson's case, I'd say The fact that her identity was verified before she entered Parliament basically makes her argument of national security being under threat with the niqab entirely moot. What she's done is appropriate a symbol of faith, which people would hopefully, in her opinion, become frightened of, inject fear, and rather than discuss the suite of other issues that are plaguing the nation, she will go back to her Islamophobia 101 agenda, which is halal certification, Sharia compliance, Muslims taking over and being swamped by them, or the niqab, all of which indicate she's got nothing to actually contribute to policy reform and everything to hide.
Were you pleased to see that both the major parties have come out and condemned what she did today?
I think as an Australian, I was pleased to see some leadership, which has been sorely lacking for quite a long time in the chamber. So that was a relief. And, I mean, this little stunt of the senator offended me as an Australian because of the disrespect that she showed for public office. And as a woman, I was completely offended that another woman would take a group of women in this country who vote, by the way, Senator, and throw them under the bus to score a point. And thirdly, as a Muslim, I was offended that she felt okay to don someone else's clothing to try and, you know, again, to draw attention to herself. If her popularity is waning that badly, maybe she needs to reconsider her media strategy and not really sort of scrape the bottom of the barrel.
Tasneem Chopra, thank you very much.
Thank you, Samantha.
The chairwoman of the Australian Muslim Women's Centre for Human Rights, Tasneem Chopra. Stockbrokers have described share trading in Telstra this morning as extraordinary. The telco is the most widely held stock by so-called mum and dad investors, partly because of its big dividend. This morning, the CEO announced that dividend is to be slashed by 30% to just 22 cents a share because of uncertainty around the telco's financial future. David Taylor takes a look at what brought about today's shock announcement.
Mark McDonnell is a 64-year-old self-funded retiree. He's typical of the type of investor that's clung to Telstra through thick and thin because of the big fat dividend check that comes in the mail every 6 months.
I think it's very important.
Telstra today reported a 33% dive in full-year profit to $3.9 billion. The result was down from last year's $5.8 billion profit, but still roughly in line with expectations. But it was the 30% cut in the dividend to 22 cents that hurt investors, especially self-funded retirees.
Look, I think to put it back into context, Telstra has clearly signalled a sustainable path for the future that is consistent with its current share price. And I think investors need to, sobering as that is, they need to take that fully into account.
And take it into account they did. Michael McCarthy is head of market strategy at CMC Markets Stockbroking. He watched events unfold this morning from his trading desk.
Oh, trading this morning in Telstra was extraordinary. I wouldn't say it was unique in the 30 years I've been in markets, but it was one of those days that really draws market watchers' attention because the volumes were enormous and the price movement was huge. In the first 7 minutes of trading, more Telstra shares changed hands than changes hands in an average day. That's how big the trading was this morning.
So this hits self-funded retirees right in the guts.
Oh, that's right. As a market watcher, it was a fascinating day's trading, but it's never far from our minds that when we see a major stock like this fall, and particularly one that's so wildly held, a lot of investors were hurt.
So why has the dividend been slashed? Put simply, Telstra as a business won't have the future cash to pay for it. Telstra is facing an NBN-induced erosion of its traditional fixed-line phone and internet businesses. Telstra Chief Executive Andy Penn says given the price NBN charges telcos to use its lines will likely double in coming years, Telstra is likely to take a $3 billion hit every year. Against this, Telstra receives something akin to rent from NBN for use of its existing infrastructure and a $9 billion payment spread over several years as compensation for Telstra giving up its traditional wholesale business. But it doesn't fill the gap. Michael McCarthy.
Up until this point, Telstra was basically paying out everything it earned to its shareholders. It had very strong cash flows from its existing operations, and while growth prospects for the future are clouded, in the short term it was prepared to pass all of that income through. Telstra is now acknowledging that once the NBN rollout is complete in 2019, it will need to start investing in its business again, and that means it can no longer afford to pay out 100% of its income to shareholders.
CEO Andy Penn fronted the cameras this morning, attempting to soothe market anxiety.
We do not underestimate the impact of this on our shareholders, and it is for this reason that we are providing advance notice of the change and why the board has maintained a 31-cent dividend for 2017. This is about setting the business up for success in the future, giving ourselves the flexibility to invest and to compete effectively.
Self-funded retiree Mark McDonnell says Telstra's dividend bombshell runs a close second to the Commonwealth Bank's earnings announcement in terms of its investor significance. But he says it's all part of the August reporting season rollercoaster.
Well, I suppose there have been a few dramatic developments on a few fronts. CBA has certainly been in the news quite a bit. Andy Penn hasn't lost his job, unlike Ian the Rev. No, I'd have to say it's all relative to swings and roundabouts of August that come each year.
Telstra shares closed the day down 10% to $3.87.
David Taylor reporting. Overseas now, and the South Korean President Moon Jae-in has promised there'll be no war on the Korean Peninsula ever again. President Moon, who took office in May, held a press conference today to mark the first 100 days of his presidency. Our correspondent Barbara Miller is in South Korea, and she joined me a short time ago. Barbara, what tone did President Moon strike?
Well, I guess the one that we thought he would strike, and that was one very much geared towards de-escalating the tensions that we've seen here over recent days. And he was keen to reassure the South Korean people, who, of course, some of whom are still alive, endured a war with their northern neighbour six decades or so ago. He assured them that this peninsula would not see another war again. He stressed that dialogue was the way to go with the North, and he even suggested that he might send an envoy there. But he said there was a red line, and that red line, he said, was that if North Korea developed a nuclear warhead, so miniaturized a nuclear warhead, which would fit then in an intercontinental ballistic missile. And I didn't exactly spell out what the crossing of that red line would mean, but he said it was very important that the international community came together to make sure that North Korea didn't cross that red line. So it was a speech. This was an appearance scheduled for his first 100 days in office. He was marking that. It was very much designed to reassure people, to try and de-escalate. But there was a little bit of tough talking in there about that red line issue in particular.
On the sending of an envoy to North Korea, is there a feeling there that that's likely to happen?
Look, I don't know. Certainly when President Moon came to power, that was 100 days ago, he was very keen to adopt a more friendly policy, a policy of rapprochement with the North. And he came in hoping that could happen. Now, of course, the recent escalation of tensions with the US has somewhat derailed those plans. But I think it was a sign that he is still keen to open dialogue with the North and to try and bring them in, I guess, bring them in from the cold. We had the Winter Olympic Games taking place in South Korea early next year. And he's also in the past mentioned that he would like to see some kind of cooperation between the North and South at those games, and has stressed that North Korean athletes, if they decide to partake, would be very welcome. So I think the envoy idea is, I guess, more of the same from President Moon Jae-in. Whether it's feasible in this current climate, well, I think most people would think not. But what he's saying is, look, we need to de-escalate. We need to focus on dialogue. And here's a concrete measure that I could take if we were to achieve that. And if the North were to stop its what he called provocations, its issuing of threats.
Amongst the people you've managed to speak to there in South Korea, are they feeling that the crisis is de-escalating a little?
I think they are, but I was a little surprised because my sense before coming here was that people really weren't taking it seriously at all. And the people that I approached today said that they were a little bit worried. They talked about the unpredictability now, I guess, of two leaders. So they've always taken on board that the North is a little bit unpredictable, although the present leader, Kim Jong-un, is it's widely seen more unpredictable than his father and grandfather before him. But then when you add in Donald Trump and the unpredictability of the US administration, they do see that as a little bit more of a threat. Now, that doesn't mean that people are not, of course, just going about their daily life. When we asked some people today about shelters, they had a bit of a laugh and they said, look, we live constantly with this threat of war, but we do see things as a little bit different and we are a little bit more worried this time. So a bit of a shift, it seems, there in attitude from the ordinary man and woman on the street.
Do you think next week's joint military exercises are going to have any impact?
Well, those military exercises do generally have a bit of an impact. We do generally see a flare-up in tensions, and they're also held, there are annual exercises also held in April, two sets of exercises held each year, and we did see a flare-up, which I think because of the current escalation we've sort of forgotten about, but we did see a flare-up in tensions in April, and most people think that the North will respond in some way. We're hoping, and it seems to be the general opinion, that that response will be verbal and that North will say, I guess, seek justification in its military program by saying, well, look, we have to have a robust defense because here we've got these people practicing on our doorstep, essentially to invade us, to wage war against us. So we are expecting some flare up in the tensions again. And I guess what we then have to see is how Donald Trump then responds to any tough talking from Kim Jong-un. But yes, there is a sense that in the past 48 hours or so, the kind of very, what felt like a very precarious situation is at least for the moment, for these few days, has passed.
Barbara Miller, the ABC's correspondent in South Korea. The American President Donald Trump has praised the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un for making a wise decision not to fire missiles towards the US territory of Guam. Reporter Jane Braslin has been speaking to the Lowy Institute's Ewan Graham. He's warning this isn't an end to the tension between the two countries.
I think this is only a pause in a phony war of words, and I wouldn't suggest that this is an end to the problems between North Korea and the US. I think we are bound to have another cycle of tensions in the future.
And in terms of the strategic importance of Guam and the Anderson Air Force Base and the other naval base located there, how strategically important is it?
Anderson Air Force Base is particularly important as a forward deployment location for US bombers. Those bombers include the B-52, the B-1B, and also the B-2 Spirit, which is still the only real true stealth bomber in the US inventory. And they have the range from there to reach Korea and other parts of the Western Pacific. So it's very significant.
And I understand that exercises are planned for next week, which will be actually run out of there.
Well, I'm not sure that exercises will be run out of Guam. That's actually a point of contention between North Korea and the US. Very interestingly, there hasn't been a single flight of a B-1B bomber from Guam to South Korea since August the 7th. And that's one of the things that the North Koreans singled out in their original threat to Guam. They don't like those flights of B-1Bs. And if the US is willing to pause those, that might be one of the areas that brings the tensions down between the two sides. What is clear is that in Korea, there's no stepping up of military preparedness on the part of the US. In fact, the opposite. We've actually had the most senior US military figure going out to Korea and saying that those exercises will take place normal. But there is no increase to the level of forces deployed by the US on Korea. So they're again, I think, subtly signaling to the North Koreans that while deterrence remains the bottom line, the US is not ramping up in expectation of any kind of military unilateral operation.
And in the immediate term, you kind of alluded to the fact that if the US was to resume military flights in the area of Korea directly, that would be seen as a direct provocation.
The United States has been doing those B-1 flights on a regular basis, particularly in response to the missile tests that the North Koreans have done, partly as a way of reassuring South Korea, which wants to know that the United States is there and has got its back. But I think what the North Koreans are actually trying to do is to use this new missile capability and the threat that they've just made to hit Guam as a way of forcing the United States to actually dial down the level of its military activity, not to engage in those B-1 overflights, and more importantly, to try and restrict the level of activity in those joint exercises which are due to beginning next week.
And I understand Australia is involved in those, is that right? And Guam is actually used as a forward post for routinely for exercises involving other armed forces, including Australia.
Yes, that is the case. Australia does take part regularly in military exercises, including the Cope North exercise in Guam. But this is a different type of exercise for Australia to be involved on the Korean Peninsula together with the US and the ROK armed forces. And that gets to Prime Minister Turnbull's statement recently that he actually preemptively said that Australia would invoke ANZUS if there was a North Korean attack on the United States, which was a fairly forward position for him to take.
The Lowy Institute's Ewan Graham speaking to Jane Braslin. Around Australia, you're listening to PM. A reminder, you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook at ABC News. The Greens are using new police data to argue the federal government's cashless welfare card should be dumped. The card can only be used to buy basic goods and is aimed at reducing drug and alcohol abuse. The government's introduced legislation today to expand its use beyond the initial trial sites in Western Australia's north and Ceduna in South Australia. But the Greens say the police figures show there's been an increase in some crimes in the Kimberley town of Kununurra and the scheme should be abandoned. Liza Borello reports.
Lola Taylor is a Kununurra woman who's been given one of the government's cashless welfare cards.
It helps me in certain ways, like that we on Centrelink, it takes money out for our bills. And it's right for food, helps us with the food. We can control it like that.
Another local woman, Dora Griffiths, also sees positives.
Settled an alcohol problem a bit at the end and the domestic violence in my area where I live.
But both women argue the card unfairly restricts their freedom. They say it should only be imposed on problem drinkers or given to people who ask for it. Lola Taylor again.
When special things come in town for our grandkids, we can't use them, you know. Like when shows come to town, the circus, the rodeos in town.
In the year since the cashless welfare card has been in place in Kununurra, the local police have recorded 277 theft offences. That's up a third on the year before. Threatening behaviour has also increased. Robin Chappell is the WA Greens MP who requested the figures.
The information that we're getting from federal government is to a large degree that it's a success. It might be a success from an observation perspective, but when it actually is leading, in our view, to potentially more crime as a result of a lack of access to cash, that is a concern.
But the data tells a different story in Wyndham, an hour's drive west of Kununurra. There, theft has gone down. Robin Chappell again.
What we did find is that at Wyndham, there was a great deal of additional work being done by various community groups up there, which most probably was having some effect. It's a much smaller community.
Advocates of the card say it's needed to combat high rates of violence in some Aboriginal communities. But Robin Chappell concedes he didn't ask for data on assault rates, child sexual abuse or domestic violence.
We didn't do that basically because we were looking at theft. And that's where we'd seen in Ceduna the figures went right through the roof on theft. And we looked at that and said, well, is it being replicated everywhere else?
Ian Trust from the Woonan Foundation, a not-for-profit Aboriginal organisation in Kununurra, says he remains firmly behind the card.
You know, to go back to a system where you just hand out cash welfare, which is basically sort of guaranteed failure over 50 years, is just stupidity. You know, I mean, here we are having a go at doing something that's different.
In a statement, the Federal Human Services Minister, Alan Tudge, said the police data the Greens requested can't be used to draw conclusions about whether the card is working, noting the variation between Wyndham and Kununurra. The minister also referenced the support the recently retired WA Police Commissioner has given it. Carlo Callaghan says it should be rolled out in other towns like Roebourne, further south, where he says 184 children have been sexually assaulted. But Robin Chappell argues the problems in Roebourne have abated.
Certainly Roebourne did have some problems. I actually get to Roebourne quite a lot. It's a pretty wholesome community at the moment.
The government is set to announce two new sites where the card will be rolled out in coming weeks.
Eliza Borello there with additional reporting from Erin Park in Kununurra. One of Victoria's most notorious prisoners, the Hoddle Street killer Julian Knight, is to stay in jail. Today, the High Court unanimously upheld a state law that'll stop Knight from being released on parole until he's incapacitated or near death. The one-time Army cadet murdered seven people and tried to kill nearly 50 others in his 1987 rampage down one of Melbourne's busiest roads. Jane Lee reports.
Senior Constable Darryl Jones was flying on board a police helicopter in 1987 and was one of the first officers to see what was unfolding below him on Hoddle Street. He saw bodies on the ground. The gunman, Julian Knight, shot at the helicopter, hitting the fuselage directly beneath Mr. Jones's feet and narrowly missing the fuel tank.
Yeah, we found out later that we were within millimetres of being a ball of fire in the sky.
Knight killed seven people and injured 19 others. He was sentenced to life imprisonment, with a minimum sentence of 27 years to be served before he was eligible for parole. But in 2014, with that non-parole period about to expire, Premier Dennis Napthine responded by introducing a law specifically framed to prevent Julian Knight from gaining an early release for good behaviour. The legislation states he can only be granted parole if he's about to die or is physically incapable of causing harm to another person. Knight challenged that law in the High Court, arguing that it interfered with the independence of the courts. But the court unanimously dismissed the argument, saying it was constitutional because it only affected the Adult Parole Board. Now retired, Darryl Jones says Knight should never have been given the chance for parole in the first place.
And I think that the result today that the High Court of Australia refused his application is a good one. Why does he deserve to be allowed out when he's affected so many people?
But Jeremy Gans, a law professor at the University of Melbourne, says the High Court's decision will give state and territory governments far more power to make laws aimed at individuals.
Well, the most immediate impact is that parliaments around Australia, whenever they're confronting a person who's very unpopular, who becomes eligible for parole, have a ready solution now. They can pass a law just for that person and prevent that person ever being released.
The only other time the High Court has ever had to consider such a law was in the 1990s for convicted killer Gregory Cable. Jeremy Gans says the debate around one-person laws has never been the same since then.
But ever since the High Court intervened, the debate hasn't been about whether the laws are just or good. It's about whether they're constitutional. I think that's a really unfortunate effect of the Cable decision that shifted the debate to what turns out to be a very tepid and unfriendly constitutional doctrine. I'm not sure we'll ever get back that time when people used to worry about the morality of just passing a law saying one person, no matter how hideous, can never, ever get out of prison, even if they'd otherwise have been eligible for parole.
Jeremy Gans, a professor of law at the University of Melbourne, ending Jane Lee's report. Australian researchers are hopeful they've discovered a new form of treatment for pancreatic cancer. Scientists at the University of New South Wales have found that treating scar tissue around the cancerous tumours can stop their spread. As Claire Slattery reports, the cancer is one of the deadliest in Australia and has seen few advances in treatment.
Former New South Wales politician Bryce Gaudry was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer last year.
Of course, pancreatic cancer has a very high death rate, and the fact that I had actually had 10 of my surrounding lymph nodes invaded by the cancer meant that I was given a possibility of only having a 3% chance of survival over the five-year period.
Like many pancreatic cancer patients, Bryce Gaudry was treated with a combination of chemotherapy and major surgery.
I was lucky, if I can use that term, to be able to have the Whipple operation. That removes your gallbladder, a major part of your pancreas. pancreas, your duodenum, and in my case, the bottom half of my stomach. It's a serious operation, but an absolutely essential one if you wish to survive.
The experience is typical of those who have pancreatic cancer. The disease is one of the deadliest forms of cancer. Only about 6% of Australians with it live longer than 5 years. Of about 3,200 people expected to be diagnosed this year, all but 300 of them are likely to die. And that survival rate has remained virtually unchanged in 3 decades. But researchers are hoping a new discovery could be the breakthrough they're looking for. Manoti Apte is a professor of medicine at the University of New South Wales.
For many years, all the focus was on trying to target and kill the cancer cells themselves. And while the treatments have worked to some extent, they haven't been enormously successful. So our focus is not just the cancer cells, but trying to interrupt that crosstalk between the stromal cells or the cells in the scar tissue and the cancer cells.
By targeting the scar tissue, researchers were able to also affect the behaviours of the cancerous tumour.
We're using this kind of two-pronged approach where you target both the scar tissue as well as the cancer cells. At least in a preclinical model of pancreatic cancer, we found a significant reduction in tumour growth, but a virtual elimination of the spread of tumour, which is often what patients die from, is significantly reduced or virtually abolished.
It's early days for the research, with clinical trials still 3 to 5 years away. The research is being funded by the Cancer Council, the National Medical Health and Research Council, and the Avner Foundation.
Claire Slattery reporting. Well, if you're planning on eating salmon this week, you're not alone. It's the most popular seafood in Australia. But scientists have discovered that fish farming methods are leaving up to half the Atlantic salmon grown in captivity deaf. The scientists say eating the deaf fish won't hurt humans, but animal welfare questions remain. Felicity Ogilvie reports from Hobart.
It takes 3 years to grow an egg into a 5 kilogram salmon that is ready to sell. So what is life like for those fish before they end up on someone's plate? Well, for starters, half of them are deaf. Professor Steve Swearer from the University of Melbourne is an expert on salmon farming.
And what we found is that the sort of universal mechanism across all of these different experiments was that fish that grow really fast are more likely to develop this deformation.
Professor Swearer found this out during research into salmon farming around the world. So what does this mean for the salmon and their quality of life? Professor Swearer says it's hard to tell.
I guess one way to think about this, though, is that we know that acoustic information is one of an important sensory modality for marine and freshwater fishes. Acoustic information can be a variety of different things. They can use sound for migration, for locating habitats. They also can use sound for communication, and they also use acoustic information to avoid predators and locate prey. So my guess is, you know, if you think about this, that your ability to detect that kind of acoustic information and environment.
Does being deaf mean that they don't have an ability not to run into another fish, swim into another fish?
We've started to look at that. So the fishes can sense, you know, when they're in a school or within their shoal, they use a variety of information to adjust their position relative to other individuals. I guess the other issue around a farm environment is that it is a pretty noisy environment. And so to one extent, while we can talk about this being a deformity that might lead to abnormal behavior, you know, it's possible that in this context, actually having slightly compromised hearing could actually be a benefit, and then the sense that they're going to be less they'll become desensitized to that noise.
You've used the word deformity. Is it safe for people to be eating farmed salmon?
Absolutely.
One thing that the study might change is the way salmon are farmed in Canada and Alaska. The fish are sometimes raised to replenish wild fisheries, but most die when they are released. Professor Swearer believes the deafness could be the culprit. The executive director of Tasmanian salmon farmer Huon Aquaculture is Francis Bender.
Obviously, we'll be looking for that paper and trying to find out what that's all about. We have a very high focus on welfare, so I've already instructed my biologists and veterinarians to follow that up this morning.
The study is being published in the Journal of Experimental Biology.
Felicity Ogilvie reporting. As children use the internet more and more and the phenomenon of fake news grows, many parents are worrying about how to keep their children away from inappropriate websites. Some experts are urging parents to do more than just limit their child's screen time. They argue that kids need to be led through the maze of the online world to equip them with the skills to distinguish the real from the fake. Maisie Cohen prepared this report.
Oh, that's a scary photo. Do you think that's real?
No.
Nah.
That's not real.
There, that's just Photoshop.
Like many children their age, 11-year-old Hugh Smith and his 4-year-old brother Nate love spending time on their electronic devices.
What about this? It's got Trump care. Is that fake news?
Yes.
And even with close parental supervision to guide them, this pair already knows that at times what they see isn't always exactly what it seems, as the older boy Hugh explains.
It depends what part of the internet you're looking at. Maybe you're like watching stuff about games on YouTube. Yeah, that's probably true, because I mean, who would want to lie to someone about that? Like, what are they going to get? But say there's like water companies are the best things ever. You probably shouldn't believe that, because that's probably like sponsored by a water company. I don't know, but stuff that just seems too unreal.
So kids are engaging with fake news from a very early age, really from the time they're engaging with online content.
Researcher Dr. Joanne Orlando specialises in the field of children and technology. One of the guest speakers at a Sydney Science Festival event examining fake news, her focus is on the impact it can have on the young.
So you might think, oh, poor kids, okay, they're growing up in this world, what's going to happen to them? Are they just going to have this completely distorted understanding about life? We spend a lot of time thinking about how we're going to get kids off their device. But is that happening at the expense of us helping them to understand what it's actually like when they're online, how they're actually supposed to be engaging with their online world?
Instead, Joanne Orlando argues that parents should help their kids to critique what they see online. That can involve giving children the ability to spot telltale signs of fake news, such as odd URLs, bad spelling and grammar, advertising links, and claims that aren't substantiated by evidence.
They're growing up in the digital age where technology and the online world is incredibly important. So we want them to be able to engage with that aspect of their life just as well as they engage with their face-to-face aspect. So what happens to them over their life is that technology is actually a positive part of their life. They're not just surviving, they're actually able to flourish in it.
I would suggest sometimes that digital abstinence and detoxing might be impractical and ineffective.
Jocelyn Brewer is a psychologist who also believes those glued to their devices can be encouraged to develop better tech habits if they're made more conscious of what they're doing online and why.
Sure, if you've overdosed to some degree or you're having trouble and you need to bring your tech use back, that might be something that you would try. But I would suggest that for a lot of young people and people who are starting out using technology, positively framing our approach is much more impactful and inspiring than creating restrictions around the way that we use technology.
Oh, it's Captain America.
Yeah, it is.
Is Captain America real?
Yes.
Meanwhile, 11-year-old Hugh Smith thinks spending too much time looking at a screen isn't a great idea.
Depends what day it is. It's fine to be on it quite a bit, but you should still be active. Maybe go to your friend's house and go to the park with them.
What's that one?
But he thinks navigating the internet and sorting the real from the fake will get easier for future generations, not harder.
Each generation is like more familiar with technology. I just see sometimes when I'm in the city, maybe, I might see a toddler in like a pram watching YouTube on like an iPad. But with fake news and spam and stuff, they might need quite a bit of teaching, because they might just think the internet's a happy place, and it's not.
Do you know, let's look for a funny one.
Uh-oh, it's called Spider-Man.
Oh, that's cool.
Scary ones are not real.
Oh, some of them are real, but that's not good.
11-year-old Hugh Smith ending that report by Maisie Cohen. That's tonight's edition of PM. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Don't forget you can subscribe to the PM podcast in iTunes and follow us on Twitter or Facebook at ABC News. I'm Samantha Donovan. Thanks for being with me this evening. Stay listening. Coming up next, Elise Morgan with Business PM.
Thanks, Samantha. Coming up on Business PM, the outgoing boss of Australia's biggest retailer, Wesfarmers, says the circus in Canberra is partly to blame for poor consumer confidence. But first, Telstra has warned investors it's slashing the much-loved dividend this year by 9 cents a share. Chief Executive Andy Penn has refused to rule out whether it could be cut back further in future years. He says the savings are necessary if the telco is to invest billions to remain competitive. Andy Penn is already under siege by investors. $29 billion has been wiped off the company's value since he took over as CEO. I spoke with him earlier today.
Andy Penn, the dividend payout is to fall next year to 22 cents. Now, part of that is going to be made up of a one-off special dividend. How much is that special dividend worth?
Well, we're not splitting out the dividend, but what I should say is that this is about setting Telstra up for success in the future. It's about moving us away from being a company that pays out 100% of our profits to more in line with our global peers and more in line with local large companies to give us the flexibility to compete in which the world we're in today.
I'm asking because the year after, once that special dividend is stripped out, will investors see another big drop in the dividend payout?
Well, the dividend policy that we're announcing today is between 70 to 90% of underlying earnings, and we've committed to pay back around about 75% of the one-off payments. And so, you know, we believe we've got scope to continue to grow the business.
Can you rule in or rule out any big further falls in the dividend?
Well, obviously, I'm not here to make forecasts on the dividend. What I should say is I'm acutely conscious, though, that the dividend is very important to our shareholders. And that's the reason why we have provided advance notice, in the sense that we're telling shareholders that this is in the future, to understand that and to understand that that's coming.
70 to 90% provides a fair bit of scope to move. And over the next few years, returns will also depend on whether Telstra can strike a deal to bring forward NBN receipts. So investors are entering a period of great uncertainty when it comes to Telstra payouts, aren't they?
The monetisation potential opportunity that you mentioned is independent of the dividend policy. And it's not completed yet. It's subject to a number of different approvals. That's just some capital management and balance sheet management, which we think that if we're able to complete that deal, that will be beneficial for shareholders. But ultimately, it's still subject to approvals, and it's unconnected with the dividend policy.
The payments that you and your rivals have to pay the NBN to access the network are expected to rise. Now, are you going to have to increase the cost of your NBN plans as a result?
Well, we haven't increased the cost of our NBN plans. If anything, we've kept the plans the same, but we've actually put more value into the plans. I mean, you're absolutely right. We are absorbing higher and higher costs associated with the provision of those plans.
And how long can that go on? You said this morning that margins are pretty low and more costs are going up.
Well, we're aiming to improve efficiency in the business elsewhere to absorb increases in the costs that go to NBN.
You're pouring an additional $3 billion into capital spend over the next 3 years to achieve what you call a step change in strategic positioning. But that will only deliver benefits of $500 million by 2021. Now, that doesn't seem like a great return on investment.
Oh, well, it's in line with basically, or in excess of our typical return on invested capital. That's, bear in mind, this is $3 billion one-off. That's $500 million, more than $500 million on a recurring basis. So that is an attractive return. But more importantly, it's actually about providing a better experience for our customers. And we've laid some of the really important foundational investments this year in our optical fibre transmission network. We've rolled out the platform network for what we call the Internet of Things, which is where you can connect devices and cars and automated driving to the network as well. We've upped our rollout of 4GX, which basically provides double the standard speed of 4G to 89% of the population. So we're really investing in some fundamental foundation capabilities which are aimed at providing a better experience for customers, and we believe it will also deliver in excess of $500 million on a recurring basis for the benefit to shareholders as well.
And some investors are nervous because Telstra hasn't got a great track record in investment. How can they be sure that you're going to use all of this money wisely?
Telstra's got a great track record in investments. We led the market in 3G. We led the market in 4G.
There's also been things like Census, Trading Post, Ooyala.
We've made acquisitions. Some of those acquisitions have not gone as well as we might like. I'm certainly not here to say that we haven't made mistakes, and also we haven't had some issues in investments that we've made. But overall, when you step back, we've made some really important investments in capability.
Andy Penn, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Elise.
Among the big names reporting today, the ABS released the latest jobs figures, showing more Australians have found new roles in the last month. The unemployment rates eased 0.1% to 5.6% in July, with nearly 28,000 jobs created. However, they were all part-time. During the month, more than 20,000 full-time positions were lost. JP Morgan senior economist Ben Jarman says the prevalence of part-time employment is concerning.
We have our misgivings about what's going on in that data. Hours worked per person aren't really going up, and the more medium-term structural trend has definitely been towards more part-time work. So even if the economy was firing on all cylinders, you know, we feel like structurally there are arguments why part-time should be doing better. This just seems to partly reflect preferences around the way in which people work and the types of jobs that are being created now.
JP Morgan's Ben Jarman there. Well, the Wesfarmers conglomerate has posted a massive 600% jump in net profit. And it was coal, not its supermarket business Coles, driving the rise in earnings. The retail and mining giant rebounded to a net profit of almost $3 billion as it recovered from last year's write-downs. Its struggling coal division staged a $700 million turnaround. By contrast, Coles supermarkets were on the slide with earnings down 13% as it poured money into competing with Woolies and Aldi. I spoke to Wesfarmers' Richard Goyder for his final profit announcement as CEO.
Richard Goyder, Coles earnings down significantly. It must signal that the golden days of the grocery duopoly is over.
Well, I don't think the grocery duopoly has been around for a while, Elise, because we've not just Coles and Woolworths, but Aldi and plenty of independents, IGA, Metcash and others, Costco, and new entrants. So if they're ever golden days, I'm not sure we enjoyed them in terms of our time of ownership of Coles. But what I would say is the business is, notwithstanding a fall in earnings, in a competitive market where the competitor has spent a lot of money on price and service, and Aldi has expanded. I think the performance of Coles, given we're doing what we need to do for the long-term value of the business, is a solid performance.
Consumer confidence is well down. What would revive it?
That's a great question. It's been supported in recent times, I think, through increased house prices in Sydney and Melbourne, and hopefully that's stabilising a bit now because we certainly don't want a house price bubble. Confidence is so critical, and I think it gets impaired to a degree by what's going on geopolitically and to some extent even nationally politically. So what would improve it? I think, strong leadership across the boards, people feeling a sense that government knows where it's going, that businesses like Wesfarmers are investing in the future and not sitting on money. And, what we need is businesses large and small, people being prepared to take risk, employ, invest capital, because it's the private sector that'll grow wealth in this country. So you've hit on the important thing, and it's confidence. And, certainly from a Wesfarmers point of view, we're going to invest a lot of money in years ahead in building our businesses. We've got a balance sheet that's ready to go if and when we find the right sort of acquisitions as well.
Your coal assets helped prop up profits. They were up for sale a year ago. Are you glad you held on to them, or are you thinking now might be a great time to flick them?
Well, we're still going through that process, and time will tell whether we get an outcome. We're talking to various parties at the moment. One thing I'm pleased about with Wesfarmers, and there's been times in our coal business when people have said, oh, you should sell it, and other businesses, frankly, because they've been through a poor period, but we tend to take a look through the cycle, and it's really great for our shareholders and the team in our coal businesses, actually, that we've had the year we've had last year, because they've made a significant turnaround, and it's good for all our stakeholders, I think.
Richard Goyder, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Elise. Thank you.
A quick look at the markets. The ASX 200 and the All Ords lost some shine in afternoon trade, both ending 0.1% lower. The Aussie dollar jumped on the back of those employment figures. It's now buying around 79.5 US cents. And that's all for Business PM. I'm Elise Morgan. Good night.